Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, rising fuel prices are creating new challenges for hunger relief efforts across New York. The regional food bank says higher transportation costs are forcing it to spend thousands more each month just to get food to local pantries. We'll learn about what those increased costs mean for families facing food insecurity and how the community can help. In Honesdale, a surprise grant worth more than $600,000 for an infrastructure project that local officials hadn't agreed to pursue. We'll get to the bottom of how the grant was awarded, why it caught leaders by surprise, and what happens next. Plus, the connection between parks, trails, and public health as we mark Great Outdoors Month, and Beaver Jam coming to Glen Wild this weekend. That's ahead after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. In southern Lebanon, two children are among the at least 10 people dead, reportedly killed in a drone strike on the car they were riding in today. President Trump intervened yesterday to stop Israel from striking Beirut as Iran called off peace talks with the U.S. until the Israeli invasion of Lebanon ended. NPR's Jawad Rizkala has more from Beirut.
The new deadly Israeli attacks on southern Lebanon threatened to derail Trump's efforts at the ceasefire deal with Iran. Iran has conditioned any ceasefire deal with the U.S. must include a truce in Lebanon. President Trump said he spoke to representatives of the Iran-backed Hezbollah who agreed to stop shooting at Israeli soldiers, and he said Israel had agreed to do the same. The Lebanese embassy in Washington further clarified Hezbollah had agreed to a U.S. proposal for the mutual cessation of attacks. And the embassy said under this agreement, Israel wouldn't strike the capital Beirut, although attacks continue elsewhere, and Hezbollah wouldn't strike Israel. Talks between Israeli and Lebanese officials are set to resume this week in Washington. Jawad Rizkalla, NPR News, Beirut.
As primaries take place in six states today, a federal judge in Boston is hearing arguments over President Trump's executive order that calls for voting by mail. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports the U.S. Postal Service has proposed rules that would carry out parts of the order.
President Trump's order from March calls for the U.S. Postal Service, which is independent of a president's administration, to come up with lists of eligible voters and only deliver mail-in ballots to people on those lists. In response, USPS has proposed using information from state election officials to create voter lists while making no changes to how it delivers ballots in the mail. We should note USPS is a financial supporter of NPR. Almost two dozen Democratic-led states and voting rights groups are arguing in a federal court in Boston that Trump's directives violate the Constitution, which gives power to state legislatures and Congress, not the president, to set federal election rules. Last month, in similar lawsuits based in Washington, D.C., a judge found it was too early for an emergency ruling that would block parts of an order that the Trump administration has not carried out yet. Democrats are now appealing that judge's decision. Anzi Luong, NPR News.
Stocks opened mixed this morning as AI companies move toward public offerings. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
Anthropic has filed paperwork with the Securities and Exchange Commission in a preliminary step toward selling stock to the public. Anthropic makes the popular AI chatbot Claude. Private investors have already valued the company at nearly $1 trillion. Demand for artificial intelligence is boosting the fortunes of companies that provide the building blocks. Stocks of both Marvell Technologies and Generac are up. Marvell designs chips for data centers, while Generac provides backup power. Crude oil prices have been bouncing up and down, but the U.S. benchmark is back above $90 a barrel. AAA says retail gasoline prices dipped about 3 cents a gallon overnight. Asian stocks were mixed, up in Shanghai, Hong Kong, and Seoul, but down in Tokyo. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow's down 121, Nasdaq down 8. You're listening to NPR. President Trump says he's appointing William Pulte as acting director of national intelligence. The post Tulsi Gabbard just left. Pulte, a close Trump ally, is also head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency and chair of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, jobs he will continue in. Pulte, who used to serve on the board of a family construction company and who owned a private equity firm, has no experience with high-level national security. He also still needs Senate confirmation for this new job. A California condor became the first of its species to fly freely in Oregon in more than 120 years. That's according to a local restoration program. Roman Battaglia from Jefferson Public Radio has more on the bird's 380-mile journey.
Condor B9 is a little over 2 years old and was released into the wild last year by the Northern California-based Yurok tribe as part of their condor restoration program. Yurok Tribe Wildlife Department Director Tiana Williams-Clausen says the condor went on a four-day trip passing through southern Oregon.
100 to 200 miles per day is not uncommon for them. She's a young bird, of course, so the fact that she's done that is particularly incredible.
California condors nearly went extinct because of lead poisoning and habitat loss. But restoration programs like this one have brought the wild population back up to nearly 400. The Yurok Tribe is hoping to release more condors this summer. For NPR News, I'm Roman Battaglia in Medford, Oregon.
Wall Street has turned into mixed territory. The Dow is down 130 points. The NASDAQ is up 5. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. The Regional Food Bank says soaring fuel prices are creating a new challenge in the fight against hunger. The organization, which serves 23 counties across northeastern New York, reports that fuel costs for its delivery fleet have increased by more than 54% compared to last year. At the same time, demand for food assistance remains high as families continue to grapple with inflation and reductions in federal nutritional benefits. Joining us now is Susan Littner, Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer for the Regional Food Bank. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Please give us a scope of the Regional Food Bank's operation and how many communities and people you're serving each month, and then how significant this impact of higher fuel prices has been on your operations and ability to get food to the people that need it.
So the Regional Food Bank distributes food to a network of food pantries, food kitchens, shelters, and other community partners like schools and Boys and Girls Clubs throughout 23 counties of eastern New York State. Our service area goes from the Canadian border down to the New Jersey border and out to Otsego and Delaware counties. So we span 41% of the landmass of New York State. And here in our service area, 1 in 8 are food insecure. It's a number that's been growing. And in any given month, we provide food to over 355,000 people through that network of 1,000 partners.
You've estimated that. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you can go ahead.
I was just going to say you've estimated that you're spending about $10,000 more on fuel this May compared to May of last year. What could that money otherwise have provided then?
Sure. So, you know, and like every family that we're serving, we're feeling the strain at the pumps. So, because of this expansive land mass and the demand for our services, we spent $10,000 more this month than we did at this point last year. And because the food bank can use $1 to provide 3 meals worth of food, that's 30,000 meals that have gone into the tanks of our trucks, as opposed to going out to people who need it. And on the flip side, just as I said, families are feeling it. I know I went to the pump and it cost me over $100 to fill my SUV this past week. And because of that, families are making choices. They're making choices. Do I feed my kid? Do I fill my tank and get to my job? Particularly in rural areas, this has hit us really hard. And so families are turning to us for food, which has caused this increased need. So at the same time as these increased costs to operate, we're having this double strain because of that increased demand for our food.
I want to talk about those broader economic pressures on families and food insecurity. Are there particular communities that are especially vulnerable when your distribution costs increase?
Really, this food bank is, I don't want to sound false alarm here. So the food bank is continuing to do everything we can to meet the needs in the communities that we serve. What we are seeing is a steady increase in demand for services, particularly in more rural communities where families are spending more on gas and putting more miles on just to get to the grocery store or to get to school or to make sure they can get to work every day. So at this point, we are doing everything we can to make sure we can continue those services, but we just need the community's awareness and support so we can continue to meet this need.
And fuel costs aren't the only challenge for everyone. How are inflation and recent changes to nutrition assistance programs affecting people you serve? In fact, yesterday, new SNAP benefits went into effect in New York.
Absolutely. So we anticipate that in our service area alone, there are 60,000 families that are going to be losing benefits as a result of the changes in the SNAP program. And so those are families that may or may not have needed services of food pantries in the past because they were receiving essential benefits. But now benefits have been reduced or eliminated entirely, and they will be relying on our services. Also, there are things, costs for shipping fertilizer to farms to grow our food has gone up. Costs to ship our food to, to grocery stores have caused skyrocketing prices across the board for things like groceries. So families are feeling these pinches all over. It just happens to be hitting this charitable food system particularly hard because we are the last stop in that food chain. When people can't make ends meet otherwise, they know that there is this emergency food system that they can turn to. And we just want to make sure we can continue to meet that need.
Are you seeing people seek assistance who may have never needed help before? And what are you hearing from local pantries and agencies as well?
So our local pantries and agencies are seeing just that. We are seeing people who never before have had to rely on the emergency food network. And we're happy to be able to meet that need at this point. But our system does have these limits. Unfortunately, so do the families that we're serving. So these are families that have been able to make ends meet in the past. They are working. Many of these families have one or two jobs in their households. And due to the increased cost of living and inflation and now fuel costs and rises in commodities, families are feeling this and are reaching out to us for the first time. Many people don't want to go to a food pantry. We are the last stop, but we are happy to be there to meet that need at this point.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Susan Littner, Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer for the Regional Food Bank. The organization serves a wide swath of communities across the northeastern New York region, and it says soaring fuel prices are creating a new challenge in this fight against food hunger. And Susan, as the Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer, what policy issues are you most focused on right now to help maybe alleviate some of this strain that's happening at the fuel pump and other economic pressures?
Sure. So first and foremost, the food bank is always concerned with making sure that we have food on our shelves to meet the need. This past year, we sustained, like many organizations nationwide, huge cuts in federal commodities that allow us to meet the need. So, last year alone, we received 7 million pounds less of our federal commodities through the USDA program that we have in the past that we anticipated for the year. So we've really worked hard to make sure that we source every bit of donated food we possibly can. But we're really trying to make concerted efforts to increase federal assistance, state assistance, and local support to make sure we can make up for that 7 million pound cut in the midst of unprecedented demand.
And are those conversations underway with elected officials about these challenges?
Yeah, so we actually just did, with the passage of the New York State budget, we did just receive some increases in funding to state programs to allow us to meet the need, which will allow us to purchase some healthy, nutritious foods. However, we did see a modest increase, but we are not going to be able to make up for the increased demand and the increase in costs with that. So far on the federal level, we continue to advocate for programs to strengthen the USDA Emergency Food Assistance Program that we call TFAP to make sure that we can get the commodities we need to distribute to our communities.
And again, emphasizing that you do continue to distribute millions of pounds of food, how are you managing to keep up with the demand?
Sure. Actually, due to amazing amounts of community support and support from our food donors and partners, we've actually increased the amount of food that we have been able to source and distribute over this point last year. We've had huge increases in the amount of food that we're able to source from our grocery stores through our retail partnership program, where we go into grocery stores and we pick up food before it spoils, but towards the end of its shelf life, and make sure we get it straight out to our network of partners and that they can get these healthy, nutritious foods out to people. But as I said before, we're seeing this spike in demand at this point. And there's only so much that the charitable food system can do at this point while we're seeing the rising costs in fuel, while we're seeing the rising costs in food that we need to purchase to make sure that our families have the support they need.
What are your biggest concerns regarding hunger and food insecurity as we move into the summer months?
So obviously, during the summer months, we are so lucky in New York State that we have the Summer Food Service Program, which is a summer component of free breakfast and free lunch. But traditionally, the Summer Food Service Program has only provided meals to children in congregate settings, things like park camps and places that, children travel to consume their meals. We've been working on a pilot program with New York State that has granted us a waiver to work with some rural communities where children did not have the ability to get out to those congregate feeding sites. If you have a parent working, you can't walk 5 miles to your school to grab lunch. So what we're doing is we're piloting this program where we are working with schools to identify some of the most at-risk children and making sure that those children in rural communities get boxes of breakfast and lunch shipped to their homes every week. So it's 7 days of breakfast and lunch to help meet that need during the summer when they don't get the school food service program. And we're seeing, we piloted this for the first time last year. We're expanding it greatly for this summer. And it really is showing, we are a model in innovation in this program. The state and federal agencies that oversee the program really have been impressed with the result of making sure that these children who formerly missed access to meals are getting them now during the summer.
And for listeners who want to help, what are the most effective ways to support the regional food bank right now?
Sure. First and foremost, you can go to our website, regionalfoodbank.net. There are several ways of assisting, of course, donations of food to either your local pantry or to the regional food bank are always, always welcome. Also, financial donations to make sure we can continue to keep those trucks fueled and keep this food flowing out to our communities. We always are in need of volunteers. You can volunteer at one of our local pantries. You can volunteer at one of our distribution centers, either in Orange County or Albany County. We're always looking for partners. So, time, talent, treasure, we welcome your partnership and are here for you. The same point, if you are in need of food services, please go to regionalfoodbank.net and click on Find Food. You'll be able to find one of our network of partners in your community, along with operating hours, contact information, so that you can get the food you need.
Before I let you go, I just wanted to ask, what's giving you hope right now in this moment?
One thing I always love to see is our network of partners is about 70% of our food pantries that we work with are completely volunteer run. And while that's a challenge, it's also a gift. And these are folks that just give every day to make sure our neighbors have access to the food they need to thrive. And also everything the regional food bank does is due to the generosity of our communities. So as much as we're feeling the strain right now, we're also seeing a tremendous amount of support. And I just want to thank everyone for helping in whichever way you can.
That's Susan Lintner, Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer for the Regional Food Bank. The Regional Food Bank collects and donates food from the food industry and distributes it to nearly 1,000 charitable agencies throughout 23 counties of northeastern New York, feeding over 355,000 people per month, and that is unfortunately rising. You can learn more and help at regionalfoodbank.net. Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tim. Have a great day.
When we come back, a surprise state grant and a debate over local priorities. Questions about how a funding application was submitted in Honesdale. We'll learn more about this controversy surrounding a stairway reconstruction project. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Vintage House, selling vintage clothing, records, books, and toys from the past. A walk back in time on Main Street in Jeffersonville. And at vintagehousejville.com. And from listeners like you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, ahead of the Men's World Cup, we bring you a new show from Futuro Studios. It's all about soccer culture in the U.S. and its underdog roots.
Why do I watch the World Cup? That's like asking me, why do I breed?
It's called American Football. And that's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view sci-fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A $600,000 state grant was awarded to the Honesdale Borough for the reconstruction of a set of public stairs, and it sparked debate among local officials, not because of the project itself, but because many borough leaders said they didn't know the grant application had been submitted. The funding would pay for the replacement of aging stairs connecting Riverside Drive, Cottage Avenue, and Cliff Street. And while supporters say the steps remain an important pedestrian link for residents, some council members are questioning whether the project is a priority and how it advanced without broader discussion by elected officials. Joining us now is the editor of The River Reporter, Liam Mayo, who's been following the story. Liam, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
So a surprise $600,000 landed in the coffers of the Honesdale Borough. What happened?
Yeah, so the timeline, as we understand it, is there was discussion, you know, between counselors a while ago about what they wanted to do with the stairs. This was something that flared up at the start of 2025, with counselors not entirely deciding whether they wanted to fully renovate the both flights of stairs, renovate one flight and remove the other, or, you know, think of other options for the entire set. In October 2025, at the time, interim borough manager Kevin Kondratic put in this grant application. Since then, he has moved on, and the borough has selected a different full-time borough manager. But what that means is when this grant application was awarded, or when this grant money came in, the person who had submitted the grant is no longer with the borough. So there was some, you know, surprise among borough officials as to, like, the receipt of this money and as to the specifics of the grant application.
So it seems as if the former borough manager forgot to leave a note. The borough officials said the application didn't require council approval. Is that typical under how things work in Pennsylvania?
That I'm not sure. I fully believe that, you know, this was done completely properly, and it's not, you know, we're unsure at this point how much the application could, you know, now that the grant has been awarded, if it could be, you know, executed without sort of further approval from council. But it is something that council, when in the first meeting after the grant was awarded, talked about and had differing opinions about in terms of how much of a priority the stairs should be.
Well, let's talk about those stairs. As we say, this announcement of this funding of over $500,000 caught them by surprise, because the last time it looks like they talked about these steps was in early 2025, but these steps have been in disrepair for years. Talk a little bit about the condition and then what the grant would do to improve it.
Yeah, so the condition of the stairs, as you mentioned, they've been in some amount of disrepair on and off for years, where you can still sort of go up them, but it's a little bit of you're doing it at your own risk. There are some steps that are a little bit crumbly. There's just, you know, some stuff that's probably not up to, you know, the top-notch standards of today's day and age. So as a piece of public infrastructure maintained by a municipality, you kind of need that to be really good in order to have it be something you can sort of authorize the use of. So this money would bring those steps up to a place where it can, again, be kind of an official path that people can take in the area. And it's something that Mayor Derek Williams mentioned, you know, they've used grants to repair these steps before. This is a bit of public infrastructure that has been repaired over the years. So this is not a first of its kind instance. In terms of exactly what the grant would have them do, that is something that, again, is a little bit up in the air right now because they haven't, as discussion went at the borough council meeting, they haven't received the actual like grant documents yet. And it's sort of once they receive those that they'll be entirely 100% clear about like, okay, these are the conditions under which we're getting this money. This is the stuff that the grant is requiring us to do in terms of like what will be done to improve the stairs.
Yeah, so whether or not they could, they have to use it specifically for the stairs or if it could be more broadly used for other projects, they're waiting to get that full grant documentation from the state. Are people still using the steps? From the pictures that you've published in the River Reporter, it looks like they're kind of blocked off. They are definitely crumbling.
Yeah. It is something that, you know, when it was discussed before, residents of the area have said, you know, these are absolutely a vital part of our pedestrian infrastructure. The streets that they connect, like, do feed back into each other, but the ways in which they feed back into each other require pretty significant detours if you're walking between them, and the detours themselves are fairly steep and not potentially the best navigable in other areas. From the resident Trey Talley speaking sort of early in 2025 about the step, he said, quote, losing these stairs, especially those from Riverside Drive to Cottage Avenue, would feel like being cut off from downtown and from the rest of our community. So there has been evidenced a need from certain residents of the community to have those steps in place.
And for folks I was just going to say, for folks who may not be familiar with the topography of Honesdale and much of northeastern Pennsylvania, that it's hilly. You need some steps or ways to get up and down that way.
Yeah. And Honesdale has a lot of pedestrian infrastructure that, you know, goes over its rivers or helps people navigate its hills. This is, I'd say, one of the most walkable areas in Wayne County, Pennsylvania. And that is something that Honesdale's Mayor Derek Williams has pointed out in previous discussion about these steps, which is he was saying, quote, it's not a unique situation for us to be questioning whether or not to invest in walkable infrastructure, but it is a unique situation that we have steps at all, and it would be even more unique if we decided to keep them. So the idea that, you know, a lot of communities are even now talking about regionally, nationally, how to enhance their communities and how to make their communities more walkable. It's a bit of a unique situation for Honesdale to have so much existing pedestrian infrastructure and to have the questions about that be how and whether we're going to invest in them and how and whether we're going to improve them rather than how are we going to work to put new models of pedestrian access in place.
And some council members expressing a little doubt about whether these stairs are a priority for the borough.
Yeah, there was some questioning about like the exact nature of the project, what exactly is possible for the project. Borough Councilor James Hamill said he had some reservations. I mean, according to him, he had spoken with residents in the neighborhood and had heard that, you know, people do use the steps, but they are serving a smaller portion of the population, and questioned whether the council had taken action to indicate the costs and benefits of renovating the stairs. And it's, you know, now that the borough has this money, there is, you know, entirely the possibility that this project just goes forward, that this money is spent to renovate these stairs to improve this community asset. But there are these questions from council that will likely need to be answered or at least further discussed before sort of the path is clear for that project to go forward.
That's Liam Mayo, editor of The River Reporter, his article, Unexpected Steps. I see what you did there. About the surprise $600,000 infrastructure grant for staircase improvement in Honesdale is at riverreporter.com. Liam Mayo, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
Take a break. And when we come back, it is Great Outdoors Month, effective yesterday. And we're going to learn more about the connection between hiking trails, parks, and community gathering spaces on public health. This is Radio Chatskill.
NEPA Gives starts on June 4th at 7 p.m. Show your support for Radio Catskill and other great nonprofit organizations serving Northeast Pennsylvania. You have just 24 hours to give from June 4th at 7 p.m. to June 5th at 7 p.m. So be sure to make your donation on time. You don't need a Pennsylvania zip code to donate. And every donation gets Radio Catskill closer to its $2,500 goal. Donate to Radio Catskill before 7 p.m. Friday at nepagives.org.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected. New York State's primary election is June 23rd. You may register to vote by mail, at your local Board of Elections, or any state agency participating in the National Voter Registration Act. Your application must be received no later than June 13th in order to vote in this primary election. In-person early voting runs June 13th through June 21st. Info at elections.ny.gov.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. June is Great Outdoors Month, and this Saturday marks National Trails Day, both serving as reminders of the important role parks, trails, and outdoor spaces play in our health and well-being. While health is often associated with doctors' offices and hospitals, experts say access to safe places for recreation, exercise, and social connection can have a significant impact on physical and mental health outcomes. I spoke with Shannon Salento, Director of Community Development and Communications for Sullivan 180, and Dr. Anjana Punthoda, a board-certified pediatric hospitalist with Garnet Health, a Sullivan 180 board member, and a board member of Parks and Trails New York.
Community health, in my opinion, is not just a focus of the well-being of the patient in my exam room. So it is generally about the population. What is going on with the population that's making them sick or unhealthy? So expanding my clinical focus beyond just that individual patient to a community, a geography or demographically defined populations. And especially by that, we're also expanding the focus beyond just clinical health into social determinants, like where do they live? What's their food access? What's their transportation? And more importantly, how are their outdoors? What is their environment like? How does it play and or impact their physical well-being? So that actually plays 80% of the health outcomes depend on the non-clinical factors like their lifestyle, work, environment. So that means it will be ineffective just to give a prescription to a patient in an exam room, but I'd rather focus on what is it that they're getting exposed to and lack thereof in an everyday life.
Shannon, Sullivan 180 has invested heavily in projects that don't look like traditional health initiatives. Why does the organization focus on parks, trails, playgrounds, other public spaces?
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, I just want to say we're so lucky to have Dr. Punthoda on our board, because as you can hear from how she speaks, she is so much more than a clinical medical provider. She looks at health so holistically, and that is why that's how we approach things at Sullivan 180. So she mentioned the social determinants of health, those things like the environment and your access to care and access to the outdoors and recreational opportunities. And at Sullivan 180, our biggest focus is prevention. That is something that is in everything we do. And something like 2% or less than 2% of healthcare dollars in America are spent on preventative measures. It's fully spent on treatment. And so if we can invest in those environmental preventative measures like parks, trails, communities, safe main streets, access to transportation, all of those things that create a healthy community, then we're only setting our youth up for success.
And doctor, when communities lack these safe places to walk or exercise or gather, how does that affect public health over time?
So that actually is, like Shannon explained, you know, these public and spaces and parks, they provide accessible environments that encourage physical activity, mental and, you know, physical fatigue are reduced, and they also foster community connections. So these green spaces are essential for physical, mental, and environmental benefits. So when there is not much physical activity, that induces stress and anxiety. Because when you are really spending a lot of time indoors, not getting that fresh air, your hormones like cortisol, a stress hormone, is secreted that actually causes depression and anxiety. Social cohesion. These spaces provide communal gathering spots, you know, social interactions. Human beings are social beings. So it reduces loneliness. It fosters friendships. And also time spent in nature improves attention span. Studies have shown that promotes attention spans and psychological restoration. So when these are deprived, when people don't spend much time outdoors, they go through physical and mental fatigue, which actually impacts their general health and well-being.
And doctor, I was just wondering, like, in terms of the physical and mental aspects of this, are there benefits that people might notice almost immediately if they get out there and do some physical activity? And then could even a short walk make a mental health difference?
Absolutely. Just even 20 to 30 minutes, Tim, I would say set a baseline. I think that initiative, that motivation for people to say, let me go outside, and actually the mood boosting chemicals like dopamine, serotonin, you know, the stress reduction, immersing just in 20 minutes every day drops the cortisol levels. And, you know, the mental fatigue part, the mental restoration, when you spend time in nature, it provides a break from your mundane activities, your ability to focus, you process emotions better. It gives you a sense of relief. And neurochemically, it's a boost. When you're exposed to natural light, it triggers the release of serotonin, dopamine, and the feel-good hormones. And that boosts mood and focus and provides a lot of mental health for the patients and for the community.
We hear a lot about social isolation, disconnectedness, particularly among youth. Doctor, are you concerned about the amount of time children spend indoors or on a screen? And how can outdoor recreation help address that?
Absolutely, Tim. This is something that I take it to heart. I see children coming with depression and anxiety, like children who are supposed to play and be cheerful, or we see increasing numbers. This is a national public health problem that most of our adolescents and prepubescent boys and girls are ending up in emergency rooms because they want to kill themselves or they don't feel good. Their mood is really down. So I think to have a sustainable health, it comes in actionable steps. I think these children should get away from their screen time. Most of it is remote, on screen these days, and children are so used to social media and click of these buttons. But human brains are not programmed to do that all the time. So I think even spending those 15 to 20 minutes, for parents, I'd especially advise, take your child out just for 15 to 20 minutes a day. Spend time outdoors. And what Sullivan 180 is doing is very commendable, and in collaboration with New York Parks and Trails, that I also serve the board for, they do a lot of activities like biking, walking on trails, and these parents and children can spend time outdoors just a few minutes a day to have that change in their mood and focus.
Yeah, and something I want to point out too that Dr. Punthoda said was really that social connection that you get from being outside in a park, in a public space, even on the school grounds. You know, our Empowering a Healthier Generation program at Sullivan 180 and our Catskill Edible Garden Project and all of our programs really are investing in the outdoor spaces at schools as well. And so the schools in Sullivan County have been doing such a wonderful job of increasing, you know, we're funding outdoor classrooms, we're funding outdoor walking trails and gardens and places where students you can bring that education in that classroom outside so that they have that 20 minutes or more, hopefully, exposure to the outdoors and to nature. And then that bleeds into their community when we fund parks and public spaces, and the municipalities in Sullivan County are doing such a wonderful job of investing in those as well. And you have those, it's not just about having access to those spaces, but it's about the activation of them as well. So, you know, there's passive activation where you have neighborhood kids meeting up to play basketball or pickleball at their neighborhood courts, or you have that more active activation. At Sullivan 180, we do a lot of work with the Sullivan O&W Rail Trail, and so we host 4 events every year to activate sections of those trails. So it's really wonderful to see both those organic neighborhood interactions as well as those more planned community event interactions. I think it's great across the board.
Absolutely. The long-term health impacts of rail trails, park improvements, overwhelmingly positive, like transforming the community by providing accessible car-free spaces. And like Shannon said, most of it is really free, not expensive or where you have to spend money, which a lot of people struggle with, but it's free. So they combat chronic diseases, reduce stress, and also lower local air temperatures, or, you know, have that mental health and physical well-being.
What kind of feedback have you heard from community members about these investments and these outdoor opportunities?
Well, it's funny you ask that, because actually on Saturday, I had the pleasure of attending the ribbon cutting at the new Canal Park in Wurtsboro, which is in the center of the village of Wurtsboro. And it is an incredible project that was a partnership of the village of Wurtsboro and the Wurtsboro Board of Trade, the town of Mamakating, and So they took a vacant lot and they turned it into basketball and pickleball courts. And when I tell you the amount of people that showed up in at that ribbon cutting on Saturday to start, you know, playing basketball and playing pickleball, and also the people that walked there from their homes in the village to have access to parks that are walkable, that are in your neighborhood, is just an incredible opportunity. And the positivity and the energy in that community that day, the connections that happen, the understanding that comes from interacting with people who are different from you in a public space that you know, you have something bringing you together. You love basketball, you love pickleball, you love the trails. It's really just a wonderful thing to say or to see. So that's more anecdotal, but fortunately I get to see things like that all the time. But we do these, our communities in Sullivan County, in both our municipalities and our schools and our nonprofits and community organizations, are really transforming spaces and creating community and creating opportunities for connection. And that's what it's all about.
As we kick off Great Outdoors Month, what's one thing each of you would encourage listeners to do this month to improve their health and connect with their community? Like small, realistic changes people can start making. Doctor?
So I would say actionable steps, right? Immediate actionable steps, tangible ones. I would say swap one daily sugar beverage for water and commit to just 15 minutes of brisk walking outside. Simple. Just one thing. To swap one sugar beverage for water, avoid soda, take a bottle of water, and just 15 minutes, walk outdoors. Don't do anything, just walk. That's a start. And I think that will actually give them a source of a well-being and feeling good and boost your feel-good hormones.
Yeah, I love that. Us too at Sullivan 180, we try to practice what we preach. And most days of the week after lunch, we'll all take a walk outside together, even if it's just around the parking, you know, laps around the parking lot, just to get together, to have a breath that's not work related and to connect with one another. I'd say doing that in your workplace is so important, as well as I encourage everyone to visit trailkeeper.org, because the amount of Sullivan County trails in Trailkeeper to connect with the trail in your community, there's so many across the county that hopefully everyone can explore a new trail and get out there and explore their community.
That's Shannon Salento, Director of Community Development and Communications at Sullivan 180, and Dr. Anjana Punthada, a board-certified pediatric hospitalist with Garnet Health and a Sullivan 180 board member. We should note that Sullivan 180 and Garnet Health are both financial supporters of Radio Catskill. Thank you both.
Thank you so much, Tim. Thank you, Dr. Punthoda.
Thank you, Shannon. Thank you, Tim, for having us.
Now, science stories from our resident science guy, Joe Johnson. He spoke with Jason Dole about some of the science stories that caught his eye this week.
So we got 3 articles today, as we usually do. The first one was about bean plants. This was in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And it's all about the common garden bean, Phaseolus vulgaris. If you grow beans, you probably have these in your garden. Humans have been growing them for almost 8,000 years, from what we can tell.
You're talking about green beans?
Green beans, kidney beans, black beans, navy beans, pinto, all of them.
All different types.
They're just different varieties of the same species, right?
Okay.
Right, exactly. Now, like most plants, they're subject to various animals munching on them, and plants in general have developed a number of physical and chemical defense strategies. They, you know, some grow thorns and spines and prickles, some use toxic and or noxious tasting chemicals. And there's a whole variety of defense mechanisms that plants use. It's like a biological arms race. It's really, really fascinating stuff. Now, bean plants are subject to attack by caterpillars. This is the larval stage of moths and butterflies, of course. And it's long been observed that predatory wasps are attracted to the bean plants when they come under attack. The wasps consume the caterpillars and use them as living hosts for their eggs. They stuff a paralyzed caterpillar into a crevice and then lay their eggs in it. And when the eggs hatch, they actually eat their maggots actually eat the caterpillars.
No, that's...
Yeah, it's pretty gruesome, yeah.
It's gruesome, but it's also amazingly complex.
Yes.
It's part of the life cycle of these plants or these related species.
Yep.
And boy, the mind boggles at how evolution comes up with some of these partnerships.
Yeah, yeah. The one that I see happen almost every year is tomato hornworms, which I have in my garden occasionally. And there's a predatory wasp that actually lays eggs on them, stings it and paralyzes it, and then lays eggs on it. And the eggs hatch and crawl into the caterpillar and eat it. And like I said, it's pretty gruesome.
You would just say there's you're just trying to grow a vegetable and there's this whole other drama taking place. And it's not just a drama. It's like one of the alien movies.
Oh, it's like a battlefield.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Sci-fi.
Oh, absolutely. Now, presumably the wasps are attracted to volatile chemicals released by the bean plants under attack. And over time, the wasps have learned to associate these airborne chemicals with this ready food source. And this creates a feedback mechanism. And over time, it's going to become hardwired through natural selection. So this is something that's just instinctual in the wasps. Now, they haven't known the exact mechanism of how it works. They identified in this study a specific chemical receptor, which is a protein in the bean plant that reacts to a chemical called inceptin. And inceptin is found in caterpillar spit. So when the caterpillars start chewing on the plant, it reacts, it causes these inceptin receptors to react. And they trigger a response by the plant that includes the release of the wasp-attracting volatiles into the air. And so to test this, what they did was at the scientists at the University of Washington, they grew plots of normal beans and beans that had a natural mutation that actually inactivated these inceptin receptors. And they divided those into three groups. One was treated with real caterpillar saliva. I don't know where they got the caterpillar saliva.
I don't want to know.
One was treated with lab-prepared inceptin. They could actually make the chemical in the laboratory. And one, they just sliced the plants to induce damage, and then they dabbed them with water. So
kind of like the control.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And they also attached dead caterpillars to the plants to give the wasps a little reward for coming to, you know, any plant. And without the inceptin receptors, about 40% fewer wasps went to those plants. And so that proves that those inceptin receptors are what's causing the wasps to aggregate.
And again, we're talking about bean plants.
Right, right.
So, I mean, Joe, it sounds like what you just told me was like the plot thickens. So you guys said this is like a movie. It's like a whole drama playing out.
I told you, it's like the
plant is under attack. And it calls in air support.
Well, we don't know if it's calling in air support. We don't know if it's intending to do that. You know, that's for scientists and philosophers to figure that out, whether plants really intend that. But it is the result. And what they also found, by the way, is that the plants that were sliced and dabbed with the water had no extra wasps. So that did not attract the wasps at all. Now, my question is, could this be used as a way to protect other crops? Could they take these genes that make this inceptin receptor, and could they insert it into other plants? And if they are attacked, they would, of course, then call in the Air Force.
It might work, might have some unintended consequences.
True, though, true, 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 true. Well, maybe we could just grow the plants next to other plants, you know, the bean plants.
That's true, too. Like,
right.
And change like your layout a little bit if you can get some knock-on effect from your neighboring plant.
Exactly.
There.
Exactly.
That's it. Well, Joe, just before we move on to the other story real quick, because you mentioned your own garden.
Right.
So your gardening, is there anything you can tell us about how gardening's going this year that might apply to what other people are seeing, just in terms of, you know, things that you're seeing from the natural environment, whether it's the temperature, the moisture? How are things going?
Well, my garden's grown pretty well this year. I've got tomatoes and hot peppers in a greenhouse, and I have four different types of beans outside. I've got squash growing. I still have a whole bunch of plants to put in the ground, though, so I'll report later on how the garden is going. But generally speaking, you know, we've had some good rain. The Memorial Day weekend that was so terrible for everybody who wanted to go out and have fun was really great, because in my garden, we got almost 2 inches of rain.
What's the next big project for your garden?
Next big project, I think, is just to finish all the beds and get all the plants in the ground. I've got four big raised beds that I haven't planted yet.
All right.
And then I have to fix my water system, too. So.
Well, just that then. But thank you for the garden update.
Yeah.
So let's move on to, hey, why not, volcanoes.
Volcanoes.
And when you came in today, you alerted me to a volcano, a major volcano that erupted 4 years ago. And I'm thinking, I have no idea where I was, because I don't remember hearing about this.
Yeah.
At the time, I must have been very busy that year. So tell us what the story is about.
Yeah, well, this was in the May issue of Nature Communications. It's about the Hunga Tunga Kahapai volcanic eruption in the South Pacific back in January of 22. This was a monster of a volcanic eruption. The explosion video from space is just amazing.
If that's what you showed me, I couldn't believe it. I said,
yeah.
How come I haven't seen this yet?
Yeah.
It's wild.
Yeah.
And it's kind of scary.
It does. It looks like an animation or something, but it's real. This eruption released hundreds of times as much energy as the Hiroshima explosion. It was huge, blew stuff 40 miles into the air. Injected vast amounts of ash and mineral grains and superheated seawater into the atmosphere, along with many different gases, including thousands of tons of, unfortunately, methane. Now, methane, we know, is a powerful greenhouse gas. It's been measured to be about 80 times more powerful at trapping heat in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide is. And it's estimated to be responsible for about 30% of the temperature increases that we're seeing here on Earth. And it lives for about 10 or 12 years, so it's a really long-lived molecule in the atmosphere. It does not break down easily. Okay? Now, scientists were studying this plume. They were using a satellite looking down on the plume with a pretty advanced spectroscope, a reflective spectroscope, which is pretty cool. And they were surprised to find formaldehyde. Now, formaldehyde does not come out of volcanoes. Formaldehyde is a fairly, fragile molecule. Okay, and it's often formed by the breakdown of methane in the atmosphere. And it set scientists to wondering what the heck was going on here. Where did the formaldehyde go? Now, the theory is that the methane chemically reacted with chlorine and bromine from the salts that were dissolved in the seawater in the process of, you know, in the presence of sunlight to produce the formaldehyde. And like I said, formaldehyde is a pretty fragile molecule in the atmosphere. It usually breaks down in around a day. And followed this cloud for about 10 days, and it had formaldehyde in it throughout the entire 10 days. So that tells us that the formaldehyde is constantly being made within the cloud. All right, so this is a process that is ongoing, if you would. Now, a similar process has been observed in the Atlantic Ocean, where salt-covered sand grains were blown off the Sahara Desert off the western coast of Africa out over the Atlantic, reacted with methane in the air, and it produced formaldehyde and reduced the amount of methane. Now, at present, this mechanism for the production of formaldehyde after the eruption is only a theory, but I think it's a really plausible one. More research is, of course, called for, but could this be used? How could we use this to reduce the amount of methane in the air? I mean, at 30% of the global warming, that's a lot of energy. That's a lot of bang for your buck, so to speak.
I just wonder, just to clarify now, are they thinking or do they know? Is the formaldehyde present because the methane has broken down and reduced, or is once the formaldehyde is there, it's helping further break down and reduce the methane?
The methane is actually formed. I'm sorry, the formaldehyde is actually formed from the breakdown of the methane.
So it's evidence of methane breaking down,
right?
And there being less methane.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And there was like 900 tons of this stuff being converted a day. So this is not, insignificant.
Wow. So, and scientists are on this, right? They're still looking into it.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, great.
Absolutely.
Finally, honestly, when you sent the list of stories we're going to talk about today, you know, I thought it was like a list of like indie bands or something, and that includes our next story, which is about Black Chernobyl Frogs.
Yeah, it's, Black Chernobyl
Frogs. Is that
Frogs.
Like a hot new punk band from That's Russia?
Absolutely. Playing in Pripyat. So this was an article in the journal Evolutionary Applications from back in April 2022. It popped up in a couple of science news websites, which came to my attention. Now, we remember the Chernobyl disaster. If you're old enough, you remember back in 1986, reactor number 4 at the Chernobyl nuclear power station in what is now Ukraine blew up, melted down and blew up and spread lots of different and very, very dangerous radioactive elements over a large area. About 58,000 square miles were eventually included into an exclusion zone where no humans were supposed to live or travel through the zone. And consequently, the area is returning to a wild state. This makes it an amazing laboratory for the study of the changes in the plants and animals there. Hundreds of papers have been published about the zone, and a whole bunch of PhDs have come out of this. Now, the paper is about the eastern tree frog, which is found all over Eastern Europe. I had to look up its range. We have tree frogs in this area, and I actually listened to the recordings of the Ukrainian tree frogs, and they sound pretty much the same as the tree frogs we have. Now, scientists sampled about 189 of these tree frogs in the area right around the reactor. By the way, if you're a scientist and you're going into this exclusion zone, there's all kinds of crazy protocols you have to follow.
Well, yeah.
You have to be tested on the way in, tested on the way out.
Take the right meters and everything, yeah.
You have to wear dosimeter badges, yep. So they captured these tree frogs right around the reactor, and they photographed them, they measured them, and they weighed them. And what they found is that these frogs were significantly darker than those outside the exclusion zone. If you look at the ones from outside, they're like typical leafy, light green color frogs, but some of the ones inside were almost black. I mean, if you look at the photos, you're going to say that's a black frog.
I'm looking at it right now, and I just got to say this about what they were originally, like emphasizing these are tree frogs. These are not like sort of frogs I'm used to seeing like around a pond on the side of the road, which tend to be like a darker green. It's like a bright neon yellow green.
Very, very light
and
green.
The dark version of this frog, it's very dark, very dark frog. And it's the same species. That's wild.
Same species, yeah. In fact, the closer the frogs were captured to the reactor, and so the higher dose of ionizing radiation that they received, the darker they were. Okay, so presumably the radiation exposure is causing the color change that they observed. And the question, of course, scientists always want to know is, why?
But that was the question I wanted to know, too. But does that mean they don't know yet?
They do. They
oh,
do.
Oh, good.
So here's what they figured out. Frogs have melanin molecules in their skin, and they play the same role they do in humans. They produce color, and they protect the deeper tissue from the effects of UV radiation found in sunlight. This is one of the reasons why you know your skin tans. It's trying to protect your tissue from the UV radiation. Now, melanin can also decrease the amount of ionizing radiation that reaches a frog's tissue. It has a couple of different mechanisms that it uses to do that. Now, ionizing radiation is the really bad stuff. This can strip away electrons from atoms, break chemical bonds, and this can certainly cause damage to body tissue. But the real problem is that it can cause mutations in DNA. If it changes the order of the amino acids in the DNA, then it's going to, change. It could cause a mutation, okay? Now, melanin has, like I said, this has several different mechanisms that can absorb and redirect the energy from the ionizing radiation. And I think this is an example of evolution in action. You know, within every population, there's variation, and some were darker. Some of those frogs were darker, and some were lighter. The darker frogs were more protected, so they lived to reproduce, to pass on those genes for the darker skin, for the more melanin. In other words, they were selected for, and over time, they think it took about 11 generations or 12 generations in order to produce this dark color.
Wow. Natural selection happening real time within a generation of human.
Oh, absolutely.
Within a human generation.
Right, right.
For us to be able to observe this natural selection around an unnatural occurrence or a cause of this. But it's wild to think that, like, again, this colorization, this the bright yellow-green frog turning black, it's not just a symptom of the radiation. It's evidence of what the frogs have done to survive the radiation.
Right.
It's
right.
Helping them.
The radiation here is being a evolutionary driving factor and causing a darkening of the skin to literally protect the frogs so that they can reproduce.
All right. Well, Joe, once again, you've taken us all around the world and introduced all sorts of great ideas we could take with us for the rest of the week. So I hope you have a great rest of your week. And I thank you for bringing us these science stories.
I will, and my pleasure.
Joe Johnson, Science Guy, and Jason Dole. Thank you guys for that. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
I'm Jason Tugaw, host of The Mixtape. I play classics you love, deep cuts, and brand new music. Friday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, sunshine mixed with some clouds, comfortable high 71, partly cloudy tonight, low 47. We'll get a big warm-up later in the week, tomorrow going up to 79, sunny, and then in the 80s, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday with a possible thunderstorm on Saturday afternoon, and then cooling down to 70 on Sunday. On Point is next.